Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
How can we come together to help each other create in different ways? And money is obviously like a big part of that. And I don't think that can be, that should be ignored. But I think that there's better ways to meet the needs of people in our communities that need that than trying to be like,
My name is Jeremy Gage, and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is an educational show involving all things tabletop role-playing industry. Listen alongside me as we hear from creators, entrepreneurs, and supporters about their personal best practices, principles, and philosophies. I encourage anyone from the budding game designer to a seasoned publisher and everyone in between to sit down with us and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. My name is Jeremy Gage, as you heard in the intro. But as always, it's not about me. It is about who I have brought to you today. And what a treat to bring it. Fun fact, this is a redo. I'll say it out loud. I don't care. My file things got messed up. So I'm happy to bring this wonderful designer, OSR brain, hardworking individual. I'd like to welcome the designer of Errant RPG to the show, Ava Islam.
None of those things you said about me are true.
That's literally, what do you mean? You're not the designer of Errant.
That's like the, well, I mean, that, you know, honestly, it is debatable whether or not I am the designer of Errant, but that one's probably the most true of the things you said. The previous three things leading up to it, I would contend.
Percentile truth. That's the age we live in. Ava, as beginning of all of these shows, would you just give a brief introduction of who you are and how you present yourself to the internet for anyone who might not know who you are and is listening?
My name's Ava. I think about dragon games and dice a lot, I guess. And I did that for so long that I ended up with like hundreds of pages of random rules. And I and people paid me money to publish those, apparently. And now I shit post on Twitter all day at Young Dumb Bitch, YUNGDUM bitch.
It's so interesting. What's really fascinating about doing this for a second time is that the first time we did this, you're like, man, maybe I should change my Twitter handle. And this time, it sounds like you're just embracing the bitch of it all.
Yeah.
I love that. I love the change in energy.
See, I think I passed the Rubicon where there was like a job thing posted on Twitter. And I applied for it, and it was like, leave your Twitter handle in the application. And so I had to like type that out in like the application for like a job ass job. And I think it like just like broke something in my brain. Now I'm like, nothing matters anymore.
This is what it is. Amazing. Additionally, Ava, for the show, Would you also sort of walk us through your journey of tabletop, like how you first started getting invested in the hobby, and then maybe what was the first instance that kind of forced you to design a game?
Yeah, for sure. So I started playing D&D like back when I was 10, I guess, when a family friend of mine, because I was a kid, and I love fantasy books, and I really love dragons. I was, like, super into, like, dragons. So a family friend of mine gave me his old copy of, like, the Mentzer Red Book, like, the Bee and Beck Me. And so, like, I used to play the solo introductory adventure in that over and over. I would reroll my stats until I got an 18 in strength. And I would occasionally play D&D with, like, him. He was, like, in his 30s, so it would just be, like, a bunch of, like, tech bros who all worked with computers and shit in their 30s, and then just like a 10-year-old kid there just excited to roll dice. And yeah, and then I kind of like, we moved away from those folks, so I kind of like lost my connection to the hobby as like a 10-year-old child who didn't really actually like know what was going on most of the time. I like briefly tried to get back into it when I like remember asking my dad to take me to the store so that I could like buy some D&D books. And I bought like what was like the starter box at the time. It was like the 4E starter box, which I guess was like the current product at the time. I didn't like know there were editions of Dungeons and Dragons. I didn't know there were like different parts, because like I only knew these like random books from the 80s and like whatever I played with my weird adult friends, my weird age inappropriate friends. And so then I remember like opening this box and there's like all these minis and this grid and shit. And I was like, what is going on?
This is looking at here.
This isn't the same game. So I like packed that up. And then I moved from Australia to Canada. And in high school, a bunch of my friends and I, we had like an ongoing board game night thing. And then the 5e starter, they all wanted to play D&D. The 5e starter thing just came out. So this is like 2014, I think. So we played that. And I tried to DM 5e for a bit, and it was basically, like, as I was, like, trying to DM 5e, like, playing it in different places, like I started playing on Roll20 and stuff, and then I started, like, Googling things, and then that led me to all of these, like, strange blogs talking about something called the OSR, and I was like, this sounds dope. Whatever these people are doing, that's what I want to be doing. And so, like, for a long time, I tried to, like, make 5e like an OSR game, and I failed pretty miserably at that. And I came, and then I had this moment where I was like, why am I trying to make this game do something that it doesn't want to do, instead of just like going off and playing these games that actually do what I'm trying to do? And that was, I think, probably that was 2016, and the Black Hack had just come out, which was like this like little minimalist OSR rule set that like everybody got like crazy into at that time, me included. And I essentially just started running the Black Hack and adding house rules to it. And I added enough house rules that eventually I was like, oh, I think I've got like a game here, like its own thing. Like there were no surviving, it had been fully Ship of Theseus. There were no surviving rules from the Black Hack in it at all. So I was like, oh yeah, I think this is something else then.
I love that. I love that the entity that is your working game now is a product of murder, essentially, when it comes to the past game. Just a little
of OD&D. Mm-hmm. This is like, it's just like a hack of a hack of a hack. It's just like an infinite chain of like just I don't even know if it's murder so much as it is just like complete like D and reconstitution. You just disassemble something and rebuild it, and you add some other random shit you found on the street into the pile.
Some Full Metal Alchemist shit right now.
I don't know. Is D&D even alive anymore? I don't think so. Like it's a corpse. Like it's fully like a walking, like animated, like zombie thing. Can you like kill what isn't alive? I don't think so.
How do you destroy that which has no life? Kill. I guess you can destroy something. A shambling horror of a game.
You can turn undead, or you can be undead.
I want to do the for everyone at home. I want to be a zombie. When you were sort of adjusting D&D 5e, what did you find was causing you the most friction to start adding some house rule things? Was it just like OSR forum influences, or was there something personal in which you were operating those styles of games that you're like, well, this isn't doing the thing that like I need it to do? And was that a result of like just you, or was it a result of the table you were playing with at the time as well?
I think it was,
if you can remember.
No, yeah, it's all, I think it was definitely a lot of like the influences of like the stuff that I was reading, of like seeing essentially like what this game could be, like what the game could be if there are like decisions to things and like consequences and stuff like that. Like just when I was reading those OSR blogs for the first time, I was looking at stuff, because like everyone pitches D&D as like, oh, like D&D is just like collaborative storytelling, which is like fun and all, but I feel like you like run into like these bits of friction where there's like, okay, you want to tell a story, and then you've got like all of this, like all of this math, what's that doing there? and you have like all of these like, you know, like all of the like Reddit D&D horror stories of like players with like random backstories and whatever, just acting like complete edgelords and whatever, or like not, you know, just like all of the problems that come when you try to use like five half paying attention people at a table as like the vehicle for some kind of narrative authorship, mostly in the purvey of like one person, it just kind of falls apart. And then I was looking at these OSR blogs basically, and I was like, oh, like goddamn, like D&D's like a game, like a game that you like you play, like it's like a video game or a board game. It has like rules, and it has like outcomes, and it has like specific feelings that are created as a result of like playing the game. And that was also like really liberating too, because like just like running a game is like way easier, and I'm gonna go out on a limb and say like way more fun than the like onus that gets placed on a lot of DMs as being like, be our little stage monkey for tonight, perform for 4 hours, tell us a magnificent little story that with voices and props and that caters to every individual player's like whims and desires and needs. I mean, more power to the people that can pull those off, but that ain't for me, chief.
Yeah, I'm not looking for the 150 session campaign that probably is necessary to accomplish that experience. Yeah, it's really the biggest thing that I always point to when that sort of example is given, when there's a conflict between like the game and then the storytelling, is Firebolt, the cantrip Firebolt that everyone's familiar with. It says you deal fire damage to a target, but can I start a bonfire with that firebolt? Can I light a torch with that? I can obviously wield the power of fire magic, so where's all my utility at? You know what I mean? Like, I know there's fucking create a goddamn bonfire, and there's goddamn dancing lights or whatever, but like, fire is fire. I don't care which way you swing it. Like, you just give it a different verb command, and it does what it needs to do. So like, I find it interesting that when someone takes Firebolt, but they don't take any of those other utility fire spells, and says, yeah, I could set up a fire for the night in this high fantasy high magic world, and I'll just start a campfire. Cool. Do you have like a tinderbox? No, but I have Firebolt. Well, that's not what Firebolt does. Huh. Interesting. Fascinating. You know, I think it's, I agree. What I'm looking for is that I agree. When you look at it as like a game with specific abilities that are on your hotbar, I think it's a little bit more of a release to engage with those mechanisms as intended, rather than trying to like shoehorn them in to give you a particular experience.
Which is funny though, because I'm all for using Firebolt to start a fire though.
Like, that's what I mean.
I think And I feel like 5e is like a little bit better than that, than like 4th edition was like kind of nuts for that, because you had all of these things which were like, you had a name for the ability that would imply that you did something, like, you know, that you have like some kind of like ability that the fighter has to like pull their enemy to them. And it's like, mm-hmm. do they use a chain? Do they use a rope, or what, how does it happen? And those things just like magically kind of like turn off after combat. You can't do them anymore. Yeah. But yeah, I mean that it's like it, more in the sense of like in 5e, it's like, what reason do you have to start a campfire? Like, who cares if there's a campfire, you know? Because there's what's the goal? Like, you know, like if the goal is to just like be like, whatever, we're gonna like tell some stories, we're gonna like fight some monsters, that's the only part of the game that like really mechanically matters, and the rest of the time in between is just like us doing funny voices and occasionally rolling a d20. But like, why bother to start a campfire if you don't have like mechanics around like sleeping or cold weather or like actually having to eat stuff to survive, which, you know, implies like in 5e there's like a fail state and a win state basically in combat only. Like, you, that's like the part where usually you like die or live, and then the rest of the game is just kind of like mostly abstract stuff. There isn't really anything to it, so like, use Firebolt for whatever outside of combat. It literally doesn't matter, because it only matters when it's doing 1d10 damage to the orc, because that's the only time you can win or fail. But like, if you have these mechanics, if you view the game as like a whole of like, we have a specific goal, which in like OSR games is like, get the treasure, survive to it, and it involves all these different steps of like traveling through the wilderness and exploring the dungeon and whatever, suddenly all of those things become important outside of combat, and then the game holistically, the win states and the fail states and all that holistically apply to like the entire experience. You don't have this weird cleaving of like, this is the game part, this is the story part.
Yeah, this is the part you hang out until you, it's like, it's almost like it's the in-between is the pause between the next time you engage with the game, right? Like, right. The game happens during combat, and then you stop playing the game to do something that breaks the pacing of that combat, and then you engage in combat again, right? Like, that's the pattern, sort of.
Well, it's basically because, right, like combat is the only part where there are mechanics that you actually have to make decisions in, right? Like, there are mechanics for other parts of the game, but like, there's not really much decision making involved. It's like, you're doing stuff and then your DM says, roll this check, and you roll that check and you either like pass or you fail. There's not like a decision to be made there. And I mean, like, this also, this is like complete straw manning. Of course, like, there are other like decisions that happen in the course of like a game outside of combat that, you know, but like, there's no systematic support for those decisions happening there. That's really on the onus of like the GM to provide those. And there's not much support for them to do so.
Unless you buy 25 different things inside of DM's Guild that lets you hobble rule. But that's a whole nother conversation. In fact, yeah. That's a conversation that leads us into all those house rules becoming something grander. Why don't you give us a brief introduction of the Errant RPG?
Oh man, like, where to begin? I guess it was mostly, it's a game that, like, Errant, I guess, is like the thing that happened that, like, was created. It's like the byproduct of my attempt to understand how to run, like, how to run dungeon crawls and hex crawls and all of these, like, supposedly, I feel like kind of just like lost techniques, like lost practices, like these things that like you see in your game, like you open up your game book or whatever, even your 5e books, your Curse of Strahd or whatever, and you see a hex map and you're like, oh cool, like a hex map, like why is this important? How does it work? What do I do with this? And it's the same with a dungeon. You open up like a dungeon map and there's a bunch of rooms, and there's a bunch of like corridors, and it tells you like all of the distances between all of the rooms, and you're like, what am I supposed to do with this?
What am I looking at?
how does this work? You know, because everyone, like, and I mean, because like through like kind of cultural osmosis, right, everyone like knows what a dungeon crawl is, but I don't know. I remember playing so many games on Roll20 where the DM would take us to like a battle map. It's the map of the dungeon. It's a really nicely drawn, like the everything's colored in. It's fully aligned to the grid. It's super nice. And we just drag our tokens onto it. And the DM like just describes the dungeon. And I just take my mouse and I click and I just start dragging my token across the map. And everybody's just kind of like moving their token across the map until eventually the DM's like, okay, you get into this room and this happens and there's maybe a fight or something and it's cool. And then it's done. And then I take my thing. I start dragging my token across the map to like the next part of the room. Just dead silence while we're just dragging a little picture over top of a bigger picture on the internet all together on a voice call. And I'm like, there's got to be more to it than this, right? There's got to be like something to like actually like exploring a dungeon that makes it a dungeon. And so Errant is really based around this idea of like looking at these old of older OSR games and trying to see, and blog posts and stuff and trying to see how they tick and like how actually are you meant to run these things, and just me like throwing rules at the wall and refining them until I was like, oh, I know how to run these now with the support of these things that I've, you know, found and developed to the point that I kind of don't need them anymore. It's one of those like little things where like I barely run Errant like rules as written anymore. It was one of those things where like for a long time I was like developing the system and I would be like, I'm not doing this right. Let me look at what I've written down. Let me change this because it isn't right. Until I eventually was like, oh, I know what I'm doing now. I don't need to worry about what I wrote down because I've like internalized it and I can like play with the formula. This isn't actually saying anything about the game though. I don't know how to fucking describe this game. It's a dragon game. It's a Dungeons and Dragons. The main innovation is that like, you know how in combat you have a turn where you like make a decision and do a thing? There's just turns for every other part of the game too. Like there's a turn in the dungeon where you can like do one thing. Like this is not new. This is in like literally the oldest editions of Dungeons and Dragons, but like kind of like the difference here is this difference in perspective where like in the older games, it's almost like a turn is like a ruler that you like place on top of a thing. You don't measure things in turns. It's more like, you know, your character has like, they can move like 120 feet in one turn in 10 minutes. And you just take the lowest movement thing of like one person. And so your characters like describe what they're doing in sort of older play. Like they're like, we're going down this hallway, and the DM would just like kind of like note until they hit, you know, 120 feet, and then it'd be like, that's the end of one turn, we're gonna do another turn. And a thing that a lot of newer old school players now are kind of the sort of modernized take is to view the turn not as like a ruler but as like a container. Like it's not like you measure things in turns, it's that you do things in turns. So instead of like you move a definite distance, it's like you move from one place to the next. The sort of details, it becomes a little bit more abstract and it becomes more about like the decision itself. And it's the same sort of thing for hex crawls. Like before, if you look at OD&D, it gives all of its movement rates in miles, right? It says you can move like 24 miles in a day or whatever. And then you have a hex map, which is divided into 6 mile hexes, which essentially just kind of functions as like a ruler to help you like measure how far someone gets in a day so that you can be like, oh, at 8 p.m., they've traveled 18 miles. So they're like at this point between this hex and this hex. Whereas in Errant and in a lot of other games, it's kind of like movement rate is given in hexes, not in miles. It's like you move one hex in a turn. So it kind of abstracts things into like the game level rather than like a game level plus like, I don't know, like a reality level as a measure. And it just does that throughout the whole game. There's exploration turns in the dungeon, travel turns in the wilderness, downtime turns in civilization, and initiative turns in combat. Because like turns are the part of the game where you actually play it. Like in 5e, when you're in a turn in combat, you're actually playing the game because you're making decisions. So why not make decisions the whole time?
Why not do the game the whole time?
Basically.
Yeah, I think that might be for my personal taste, I also think I'm very much a person who is in the camp of kind of making sure everyone does something in a round. Because I think I find some struggles in games like PBTA or Blades in the Dark that don't really have like a turn or like an order or like something like that. And so I'm another layer of GMing is keeping track of who's doing too much, who's doing too little. Am I supposed to engage with the person who's doing too little? Am I supposed to pull the reins on the person who's doing too much when it comes to like more narrative style play? So I find it really interesting that there are procedures for also that in between time that kind of honestly takes a little bit of a cognitive bit from the GM as well.
I don't do anything when I'm GMing though. When I'm running errant, I don't fucking do shit. It's like the easiest thing. It's a game that like plays itself. I'm like basically the equivalent of like, you know, in Fallout when you like click an enemy to attack and then there's a little text box that comes up that's like you rolled a 19, you dealt 4 damage. Like that's just me. That's all I do when I run games anymore.
I'm a whole ass text box.
It's true. Cause like, okay, like I guess the other thing that makes the turns work, the other thing in conjunction with the turns, the other sort of systematic element of it is what I call the event dice. It's usually known as in OSR circles as things like the overloaded encounter dice or the hazard dice. It was sort of pioneered by Brendan S. of necropraxis.com. And so what it does is basically like in your traditional dragon games, each, you know, you have, like I was saying, you have a turn in the dungeon, which is like 10 minutes. And you have all of these little things that are like, okay, like every turn you roll a d6. On a 1, it's you run into a wandering monster, right? And every 6 turns, your torch goes out. Every 24 turns, a lantern goes out. And every 6th turn, you also have to take a rest. So there's all of these kind of like little bookkeeping things that you have to do. What the overloaded encounter die does is it basically takes that dice that you roll at the start of every turn that tells you if you have an encounter or not, and it puts all of the other bookkeeping stuff, it shoves it inside of it. So it's something like, if you roll a 1, there's like an encounter, and if you roll like a 2, you have to rest, and if you roll like a 3, your torches burn down, and if you roll like a 4, just something related to the area happens. If you roll a 5, you get a sign of the next encounter that you'll have, and if you get a 6, there's nothing, you don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. And what this basically does is it creates like a really easy, like sort of like almost like a Boolean flow to the game of just kind of like logic gates and like a procedural flow of like, I ask the players what they're doing, they tell me what they're doing, I resolve the results of what they did, I start a new turn, I roll the dice, I resolve what happens on the dice, the players tell me what they're doing, and it just kind of, and you don't really need to worry about anything. You don't need to worry about like pacing, because like the game takes care of that itself with this sort of thing. You don't really need to worry about like spotlighting characters or making sure. I mean, there's obviously still some of that, but I feel like it definitely is the most stress-free GMing that I've ever had to use this sort of system.
I think there's also something really interesting there too when the events die sort of takes over the what do you have to do at this space, location, in this turn or whatever, that is sort of like predetermined results in a way. I think one of the fallacies? I don't know what the right word is, but there's this thing where like, you know, you're engaged in combat in D&D 5e and you go, I'm going to attack the goblin, right? And then you roll your D20 and then you miss. You're like, oh, I guess I'm not attacking the goblin this turn. Like there's this dissonance, right? Whereas if you have this roll that sort of happens and said, hey, here's the next thing you have to role play towards, right, or like that you have to fictionally think about moving forward. Like we are resting here. That is not an option or what have you. And it's like, okay, let's give a reason why we're tired or something like that. You know, I think that just, I think it helps bridge a gap that I think D&D doesn't quite have when it comes to role playing for new players, and that like you have to explain the thing that you're doing and just giving you sort of a prompt. It's almost like a prompt in a way, I guess, as I see it.
Yeah. Well, it's because it's not exactly like telling you fully like what's happening. Like it doesn't create a scenario, a whole plot.
Right.
Like, use it with a dungeon. I guess I skipped a step in explaining what I do when I DM, which is like usually it's like players are in a dungeon, they enter a room, you know, like I describe the room, I roll the dice, stuff happens. It's like risk versus reward. So it's like in the thing that I was describing before, when I was just dragging my token like across the room. Also, this can be on the record.
Cool. On the mic.
You know, there's like no consequences to what you're doing in the dungeon. Like, why are you in a dungeon at all? Right. Like, if you don't have to think about things like light or, you know, food or getting tired and exhaustion in the dungeon. So what the event dice there is for is not for like success or failure. Like Errant has its own success or failure mechanic, which also tends to be quite binary. I think that's like an okay thing. It like fail forward doesn't need to be in every game. They suit different play styles. What the event dice is there for is to create like risk and to create consequences to your actions, because you can't just sit there and like do everything, because every time you do something, there's a chance you might run into something that kills you. There's a chance that your torch burns down. There's a chance that you need to rest and eat some food or something, which means that your resources are slowly depleting. It just basically is like a tool that is there to ensure that consequences have actions, basically, that like every decision that you make is met like with resistance, so that you can't essentially make all the decisions given enough time. You are like limited in what you have to do, which makes the decisions that you make meaningful.
Yeah. In our previous talk, you said you had mentioned that Errant's is sort of like a more of a, you might have to correct me if I'm wrong, but more of a procedures heavy style game rather than like a mechanics rolling or like dice sort of game. There's simple dice rolls, but it has a lot of affordances built around it. And is this something that has come from like those OSR frameworks, or are there other inspirations for those things outside of OSR that have contributed to those designs?
Definitely, like most, like almost all my primary inspiration is OSR stuff. A lot of Errant was just made by like looking at things in like BX or AD&D first edition and looking at it and thinking like, what purpose does this rule serve? Like, what gameplay state is it here to like try to create, like encumbrance, you know? It's a thing that gets ignored because it's annoying to like track the different arithmetic weights of everything you're carrying, but it's like, why is this here? Like, this has like a purpose, this has like a reason, which is like in a game about like carrying treasure, how much you can carry is important, and the more you carry, the slower you are, which is also important in, you know, when you're in a game that takes place in like tight corridors where you might get chased by things with like sharp teeth, you know? So it's like, okay, there's like a definite reason for this rule. There's a definite reason for this rule or procedure or whatever you want to call it being there. It creates a specific gameplay state. So how can I like replicate that with what I feel like are is in a way that's easier to run for me, at least, and hopefully for other people. But I really did design things with like me as the primary audience in mind, first and foremost. Like, this is a game that I use to run my own game. So if other people can use it or use parts of it, that's fine. But it's mostly designed for me. But definitely, I have inspirations from other places. Like, I really like Blades in the Dark, and so there's like a little bit of that in there, in like the sort of position and impact mechanic, where you sort of lay out what the stakes of a role are before you actually do the role. There's a couple of like, I think I was looking at a couple of story games when I was designing the Deviant class, because their whole kind of shtick is that they break the regular rules of the game and kind of play with like the narrative and the systems of the game itself in the way that a lot of story games do. So I think I was looking at Rogue 2E by Kazumi Chen. That was one. And The Treasure at the End of This Dungeon is an escape from this dungeon, and we will never escape from this dungeon. I think it's called by Riverhouse Games. The treasure at the end of this dungeon is an escape from this dungeon, and we will never escape from this dungeon. That's the name of the game. So yeah, there's like a few little bits and pieces of inspiration from elsewhere, but yeah, primarily OSR stuff usually, and usually like, yeah. I don't know what the second thing was going to be. I was gonna say something, but then I realized it wasn't true right before I said it. So I was like, no, we're gonna let that die in my brain.
That is how the human brain works, everyone. Yeah, I had the pleasure of playing Errant. What's great about this version versus the other version is I've actually played Errant this time. Yeah, I played the game this time. So I played the Deviant, and I loved sort of like this flashback mechanic sort of thing that was built into there. And, you know, glad everyone liked Ace. If you remember that stream, you know, he'll be coming back every once in a while. He's my multiverse character. Make him for every stream. But yeah, it was interesting in that I liked how, just from a player character experience, it's sort of like a live, you know, how did you like the game person I'm being interviewed by? Not that you asked, but I liked how a lot of the stats kind of correlated on the character sheet to different bits and bobbles that are involved in the game. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but MV did the character sheet design for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Great job by MV. But to speak to the Deviant, I am sort of like, I like to mess with the narrative. I like to push the game a little bit, or push on the fiction to see like where the bubbles burst a little bit. And then I'll like rein it back, and I'm not here to be a dickhead, but I like to push the boundaries for sure. But the Deviant is exactly that, and really allows for me to really just spend those tokens, spend those, what are they called? I have it pulled up. Don't say it. I want to do it. Deviant. I use those jetons to make a wager. And I also love how the GM gets to do sort of a devil's bargain thing as well, to sort of like, lets me know what it's like I'm trying to burst the bubble of the game, and the GM's like, cool, go ahead, try to burst my bubble. You fuck it up, though, it's going to be all bad news bears. So it was a really great experience, and I really loved everything I got to do for the Deviant. It's been a little while since our first version, but I guess as far as like what a player is doing in the game, were you just trying to like nail the four classic, like typical classes that like existed in AD&D and everything like that? Go ahead, you, Sam, you get in here. What were they?
Oh, AD&D had a bunch of classes, more than four. The class, I don't think there's actually ever been four classes in D&D.
Really?
I think OD&D had your fighting man, your magic user, your cleric, and dwarf, elf, and hobbit. And they were called hobbits in the very first printing, and then they got sued.
Rest in peace.
So there's never been actually the classic four. There's never been an edition with just four classes. But the four, classic four are what everyone thinks of, is your fighter, your rogue, your wizard, and your cleric. And yeah, I did want it. I don't think you need any other classes. I mean, there's like two arguments to that, I guess. Is the one is that like, oh, like I want a class for each character concept. Like a fighter is like not the same thing as a barbarian or whatever, like in the fiction. To which my answer is like, why not? Like, yeah. But like then like it becomes one of those things where like it sort of justifies itself. Like if you have a game with like really tight tactical mechanics or a lot of like mechanical differentiation, like sure you can have those things and then they can like play in very different ways, but Errant is like not that game. And then it's the other thing is just that like what, like how many things do you need for your game to function? Like what are like all of the things that you that happen in your game, and do all of the classes provided give players all the tools they need to handle those things? And if yes, then I don't think you need more things than that. But yeah, I mean, I did try to like structure, and that's why I call them archetypes too, because I tried to structure them in such a way that was like, these are like the four big roles. They're not like character concepts in the way that like a barbarian or a monk sort of implies like a very strict, like it doesn't just imply like what your character plays like. It implies a lot about like, what do they look like and what was their background like or whatever. And so archetype is meant to be much looser, where it's like, they're not a fighter. They're the violent. If your character does violence, regardless of like how they do it or what they look like when they're doing it, or whatever, they fit in that bucket because their job is violence. And there's like little choices within the class that like allow you to be like, I'm going to personalize this, and I'll maybe get like a little mechanical like widget for it. But yeah, that's
widget.
Yeah, you know, like a little like a lot of things in Errant aren't explicitly like, you know, you get like a plus one for this or whatever. But it's like, if you're a rat person and you want to identify cheeses by smell, and you're like, I'm going to be good at this because I'm a rat person. Like, sure. Okay. I believe you. Why would you lie to me? we're already lying. Like, I don't need you to find the law in the book that says that you're not lying to me, that a rat person is good at smelling different cheeses. You know, that's fine. Yeah. What are we talking about again? Did I want to nail the feel of the four different classes? Yeah, I did. I wanted them to all play differently. Like they all have different subsystems, and I wanted them to when you play a different class, to feel like you're doing a different thing, like you're playing the game in a different way and making different decisions than if you had picked another class. Yeah, that's it, I guess.
It makes me, because I'm thinking about, you know, what is a class as I write some things in my own personal time. And one of the things I've been really fascinated by is, like, I think you said basically the two things that I'm thinking about is like, is a class a character concept or is it a tool set, right? Like, I think when you talk about this version of archetypes, it feels like a tool set or a teachings. And then that makes me think of like jobs from Final Fantasy. I don't know if you ever played Final Fantasy or any of the game, but I think about like how jobs and professions work, and like, hey, there is a guild for paladins and they teach you these things, but a paladin can be, I think there is this line that D&D could have where like the base class is the tool set and then like the subclass is the character concept, right? Like, I think that's, as we're talking about this, that's what my brain thinks of. And that like,
that's AD&D second edition.
There you go. See, I haven't read it. I don't know. But, you know, it's like, I think there's just something in there that when you have these games that the world's most popular role-playing game, the world's only role-playing game, the big ampersand. We talked about this on the previous episode about like the original character culture and how a lot of those concepts are being brought into, and I still have that article, so I will link it in here for people to read, but in the show notes. So go ahead and check out that article. It's really good. But you know, it's that thing about bringing your character concept and layering it on top of what the game is trying to do. And I think sometimes you get kind of pigeonholed. Well, maybe, see, this is how my brain works. I talk about it, but then I like argue with myself internally, and I'm like, well, that's not necessarily true, because then it can help people, like, if they've never played a role-playing game before, it can really help drive like what their character might be behaving as in the game or something like that. Anyways, summation, archetypes, nailing them. I think it's very cool that you've thought about how to allow people to sort of play whatever they want in a lot of ways, and then give them basically, it's almost like a deck of magic cards. Each magic deck is a deck of Magic the Gathering cards. I should be specific, because magic cards might be like just a trick deck, a sleight of hand deck. But, you know, a aggro red deck is going to play differently from an aggro black deck, and a black deck is going to play differently than a green deck. So like, I think taking in classes that do very different game things are basically a different game in of themselves is very, very cool and adds a lot of like replayability and entices a person to like want to play something different as well. Like, ooh, I played the Deviant last time. This time I'm going to play the Violent because I just want to see how that game plays if they're that curious, right? I think it's I think it's a triumph. What were, in making a game like this, what were some of like the biggest challenges in design? Something you just really struggled with for like more than 2 days, because, you know, I consider you a genius, but that's just me.
Like really dumb shit. like most of the big stuff was pretty easy because I stole it from other people, so I didn't have to think about it. Like, but like really dumb, minute stuff like movement mechanics of like of just like being like, what dice should I use for this? How does the number that they have here translate into how many spaces they can move, and how many dice should I use for? I broke down my long struggles with the movement mechanics in a blog post. But yeah, it's usually stuff like that. Like one time I spent like an entire day trying to think of, so like in Errant you have like three types of weapons. They're heavy, medium, and light. Mm-hmm. And basically the only difference mechanically between them is that heavy weapons do +1 damage and medium weapons do -1 damage. But like, I really didn't want there to be like any arithmetic in my game. So I spent like a full day just like agonizing over like, how can I represent a damage increase like this, like that minute in a different way? And just trying out so many different permutations of like different ways to represent it with dice or whatever before just being like, none of this works. I'm just going to keep it +1, -1. Stuff like that. Other stuff is just like in the magic system, you know, there's no set spells. You roll a bunch of different, there's like a bunch of different grimoires. There's like 100 of them that are like these like creepy objects that like determine, that like are prompts for what kinds of spells you make. And just like coming up with like 100 of those and like 3 miscasts for each of them was just like hard and a slog. So just stuff like that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, who is it? Adrian is their name?
Yeah.
Who played that class? The name of that class being?
The Occult.
Dang it, why? I have it. Just let me get to it.
I'm sorry, I didn't know. I didn't know if that was a prompt for me.
No, it's your game. I should remember it too. Yeah, Adrian really loved the magic system you ended up creating inside of that because it makes it feel so much more grounded and tangible because you make items matter. You like make the components of the spell matter. And I know that in some cases, people who play spellcasters D&D 5e can, like they can choose to, but most of the time materials are like hand waved, right? Like I just cast fireball. Cool. Did you have the bat guano you needed for that? You know what I mean? Whereas this, it's like the spell originates from the things that I'm creating, or the miracles originate from the thing that I'm creating, which is very, very cool. And it's also like a fun creative exercise for the occult player as well, which is really, really awesome. What on the opposite end of the spectrum, what's like your favorite piece that you made for the game? Like something you're really proud of?
I love the downtime mechanics and the way that the downtime mechanics and like the downtime mechanics in combination with like the rules for XP, I just think make the game. So the rule for XP basically is that you get experience in two ways. You get experience for money wasted. So money that you spend on just like drinking a bunch of booze and partying and doing drugs, money that you that is essentially useless to you. And you get experience for whenever something you bought like becomes unusable, even temporarily. So that doesn't matter if it's like your sword breaks or your cow is stolen or someone deposes you from your kingdom, once you have like a thing that you've put money into that you can't use anymore for any amount of time, you get experience for that. And I find that it creates this thing where, so like, I feel like in a normal dragon game, you know, you look at the prices and it's like a loaf of bread is 1 copper, you know, and 100 coppers makes a gold, and your character, your goes into a dungeon for the first time and comes out with like 3,000 gold pieces. And it's like, why would you ever do that again? You have so much money now, just live the rest of your life, you know? And then players want to do things with that money. And they're like, I want to set up a bakery. And it's like, cool. And they get so invested in that bakery. And the game just threatens to become like Bakery Simulator 2021. And it's like, that's rad, but we're playing Dungeons and Dragons. You have to go into the dungeon and fight the dragons. That's what it's there for. And so I feel like these rules like help with that, because it does this thing where like you go, you get your money, you have to waste it. And then there's another rule, which is the lifestyle rule, which is like, instead of being like, oh, for a month, you know, it costs like 100 gold pieces in rent and 20 gold pieces for food or whatever, it just is like, whatever money you have left at the end of your downtime turns, when you're about to go back onto an adventure, is halved. Like, no ifs, ands, or buts. Doesn't matter if it's 100 gold or 10,000 gold. Whatever you've got left is halved. And I find that creates, you know, that very sort of classic feel that you get in these old swords and sorcery stories, or like Cowboy Bebop or whatever, where your heroes are like always fucking broke. Doesn't matter what they did, they're broke. So they're broke now, so they need to go and get more money, and then they're going to use that money to pay for the shit that they broke while they were adventuring. But it also does the second thing, which is that they're like, I'm going to lose this money anyway, so I'm just gonna spend it on stuff. I'm gonna like buy a bunch of things, or maybe I'm going to like set up a bakery stall because my players want to make fucking bakery so much. I put rules in it for that, and then their bakery now becomes like a source of adventure, because when you roll the event dice during a downtime turn, it might be like, hey, someone is poisoning your flour and you can't make any more bread until you find out who poisoned your flour. And so now you get XP for that. You get XP for your bakery. And now there's an adventure for you to do, because you got to go find out who's poisoning your flour so you can get your bakery up and running again and get XP from it later. And it ties everything. It does the thing where it like lets players do what they want to do, which is like come up with random shit to do with their money and invest in the world and stuff. But it creates at the same time like a loop that keeps the focus of the game like on adventuring. It doesn't like devalue all of the stuff you do in downtime, being like it doesn't matter. Like if you have a bakery, that's going to give you like in-game bonuses for when you adventure. Like you're going to have a bunch of fresh loaves of bread to bring with you on the stuff. Maybe that's going to like give you a boost to your health or whatever. But it just like makes sure it like it ensures that it like ties in, that it complements the other part of the game, mm-hmm. without like overtaking it. And I really like how elegant that system is, and the way all of these different parts of the game like feed into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mic drop. It's good. And, you know, I think that is something that in my earlier days of GMing, I kind of struggled. I ran, was it called Dragon Heist for D&D a while back? And they get like it's built into it that they get a headquarters, like they get an inn or an old tavern that they can just have. Let me tell you, the adventure full stops at level 2, and we just go into an HGTV channel series of just renovating this place and making dollars. No one cares about the 500,000 gold that's hidden somewhere in the city. Yeah. And, you know, in one of my minds, I'm like, well, let's just turn that into a dungeon. Let's just open up the basement of this thing and just go in. But yeah, I love that you've taken the consideration to sort of connect everything in terms of the fiction or the procedures that are present in the game, because it allows it to sort of feed into itself and can really like, I mean, I don't know what the cap limit of play on a single campaign is for this game, but it seems I can go pretty indefinitely based on what I'm looking at slash what I'm hearing here today. Would you agree? Would you disagree?
Yeah, I mean, I think Errant is built, like, I mean, a big part of that, like, a big part of the reason why those downtime mechanics and stuff is in there is because if you look at, like, all of the old original editions, it's in there, right? Like, in OD&D, your ninth level ability as a fighter is not you get an extra attack, it's you get a castle and people, and you get, like, retainers, you get an army to go with that castle. So this whole part of the game where, you know, you like invest in the world and you change it and you like build stuff has always been there for the beginning, and it's tied to its like wargaming roots, right? Like the idea that like you would advance a D&D character to like max level and then they would become like the general of your army for your war games or whatever. And I think that like kind of reflects in the fact that like players want to do this kind of stuff even from the first level, because, you know, opening a bakery is basically the same thing as opening a castle at just at different scales. Mm-hmm. And so it was about trying to find a way to take that aspect of the game, the domain game, and make it more gameable and integrate it through like the entire structure of the game, not just something that you do at the end of it. But yeah, at the same time, Errant is designed for campaign play, like long-term play, like those old dragon games. And I think that's like where it really shines. Like, it's fine for a one shot, but like, honestly, if I was going to run a one shot for my friends, I wouldn't pick Errant. I'd pick like Into the Otter or something like that. Mm-hmm. But Errant is a game that like, I think like really shines when you play it for an extended length of time.
And there are definitely people who are hungry for that style of play that will actually like feed in, you know, what is the end of D&D but level 20 or Fizzle, right? Like one of those two things are going to happen and then it's over. Amazing. Errant RPG, go get it, buy it, tell your friends about it, share it, give Ava money, give all the other collaborators money, or just give Ava money. I don't know. Just send it to a PayPal account. Yeah, so usually in this section, Ava, I ask, you know, what sort of trends are you seeing within the industry, in your own social circles, Discords, Twitters, Facebook groups, personal text messages, whatever, or what are you seeing in the industry that's being maybe detractive that you want to caution people against, or maybe give a new perspective to that angle? Excuse me. Or if there is a trend within yourself that you would like to give to a listener that they can just run away with, and kind of tying that up with the tip section as well, because you have a really amazing blog that I have found like my favorite one so far is the concept of someone turning into a dragon because of their horde. I think that's a really fascinating article. But yeah, if you have like an article someone should read, or if you want to like get into one on here, I would love to hear about it.
Thinking of this time limit blog post by Ian Newsom, who's a big, big person in the Mothership community, big organizer there. Mothership did super well. So many projects in Mothership and Zine Quest 3 made just a bucket load of money, and that really came down to the way that these folks were all collectively organizing and helping each other and stuff. And so, like, this is going to get political because I've been reading Marx.
Let's go.
Right before I came onto this. But
the show's about perspectives, Ava.
I think there's a trend in online RPG discourse that is kind of indicative of, there's like literally no way for me to say this without sounding like pretentious as hell, but like kind of like a bourgeois mentality in which we're looking at all of the problems besieging us under late capitalism, of like the starvation wages most of us live under and the struggle to like find meaning and make things real. And our response to that and the response that I'm seeing in a lot of RPG spaces is this idea of like professionalization of like being like, you know what you should do? You should charge money for your work and you should like set your rates like higher and you should like pay all these people you work with. And like, these are all like good, like I'm obviously not against like paying people you work with and charging for your stuff. But I feel like it is this like kind of like response of neoliberal capital, like inching its way into every part of our lives, even to this like corner of our hobby space. And the response to that is just like, cool, like lean in, like accept the market. You know what I mean? And like, let's set like professional standards. Let's treat each other like professionals. I'm seeing folks that are being like, you know, they're putting out SRDs and they're saying like, yeah, in my SRD, I'm saying like, you know, if you're a first time designer or whatever, like sort of like, and you read this and you make stuff, like charge for your work, like you did labor, that's important. And it is important, but I think what it is reflective of is like a sort of failure of imagination of thinking of forms of community and organization that aren't dictated by the logics of the market. And I think about like this idea too, that like, if you say this, you're saying that like, oh, poor people don't deserve to like make games, or, you know, you're saying that like we should starve because, you know, we shouldn't charge for our games. And that's like absolutely not what I'm saying. I think like one of the things that I've realized doing over the summer, where I haven't been working my day jobs a lot and I've been doing like some like contract RPG work, is that it's like so much harder to do this stuff and to be creative about your hobby when you're relying on it as your sole or one of your main sources of income. And I think that this idea that we have to like confront each other as like these sort of like market professional artisans, producers and consumers of goods, is like one that's kind of like hurt our community long term, especially like people coming into the space and like making things of their own for the first time, and they put it up on an itch page and they charge money for it, and suddenly like nobody buys it or nobody reads it or nobody comments on it, and you're kind of like iced out of productive feedback or discussion that could like help you long term. And I think that just Ian talks about RPG communities and collective action. He points to like Dissident Whispers, which was like an entire volunteer project that came together in such a short amount of time and did such an incredible amount of like high quality work that I think like really speaks to power to the creative potential of people in communities and the ability to be motivated by things that aren't, you know, money, especially when you have people in there that are like supporting you tangibly, where, you know, everyone's like, we all have these skills. How can we put them together? How can we come together to help each other create in different ways? And money is obviously like a big part of that. And I don't think that should be ignored, but I think that there's better ways to meet the needs of people in our communities that need that than trying to be like, buy my PDFs. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like I'm in a community like this, and I have been for a while. And it's like the main reason Errant got made is because all of the people in here are like, yeah, we're going to help you make your thing. And I help them make their things. And we have like a mutual aid fund that we just like all donate into. And when people need help and when people need money, you just get it from there. You don't have to worry about like being like, oh, pay me for this job or buy this thing from me. And I think that does like a lot more collective good, honestly. Mm-hmm. And again, this is not to say I think paying for games is bad or paying your contributors is bad or any of that stuff. But I just think that there needs to be an awareness of like the drive towards like, I don't know, like market logics and market solutions, and to try to think of like alternatives around that, alternatives based on like community and mutual aid and support and skill sharing. I think that is like a much healthier thing long term.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring this up. A little while I've been thinking about doing a sort of what would be the word that I use here? Firm or agency, I guess, where I find a couple of my best gal pals in design, and we, you know, I recently discovered that I like designing like lore and monsters and GM stuff. And I'm not good at like systems. I'm not good at like doing dice math or card math or anything like that. And so I was thinking about pairing up with different individuals who have different specific skill sets so that we can each help to create or fully realize our dream pieces of content. For instance, I helped Spencer Campbell with Nova. Spencer couldn't really wrap his head around like making up lore. Just it felt like a little bit of a slog to him. So I was like, hey, I'll help you with like lore and creatures and GM stuff. And he has a full ass system. Viditya Valetti is the same way. Loves making systems, does not like writing content around those systems. And so I was thinking to myself, like, what if, you know, if I could just get like one systems designer and myself and then like an artist or illustrator and like kind of bring that stuff together, would that be more powerful and kind of more resonant community wide than if I were to keep trying to just like make my own stuff solo all the time? Are we on the same page here in terms of like what we're discussing here today, or am I missing something? I'd love to eat my own foot.
No, we're definitely like, I just like, I'm thinking of like going, like, I think the cooperation and stuff is like the fundamental aspect of it. But I also like want to think about it or bring it into a space that is serving as like, that's creating, it's about creating spaces for people to like make things with like less pressure from the sort of like demands of like, oh God, like I have to fuck, how do I say this? Just like less pressure from like the demands that like we quote unquote like value like everything we do, that like we can't just like do anything for like fun or joy, like everything has to be for an objective and has to like add to our personal value. We need to be like leveling ourselves up or hustling or grinding or making something to sell. Just about creating spaces where people can, because people want to make things and people like love to make things. And if you look at the history of like what the internet has done, or like, you know, people have come together to create like amazing projects built around volunteer labor, right? Like things like Wikipedia or like crazy Minecraft servers or whatever, that I think like show proof to the fact that like people, regardless of who they are, like if they're like, you know, like, and a lot of these things are not being done by fucking rich people. These are being done by like poor working class people who want to make stuff. And I think as the pressures of capitalism rise and everything becomes like a gig, it becomes harder and harder to do that kind of stuff on your own without having to feel like or resort to, oh, I can't do this for free. I have to like sell this or turn it into like a professional product or something like that. And I'm thinking about how we can come together to create spaces that take that pressure off of us a little bit. Of we can make things together and we can do things as a community effort, and it, and we can support each other artistically, financially, whatever, so that we can just like make things, you know, and that we don't have to be like, here is my brand, here are my products. And that is like how we consume and regard each other's creative output. You know what I mean? Through like a storefront.
Yeah, I think that, or my feelings are geared towards fully agreeing with you. I think that you're saying a lot of interesting, I think a lot about like the concept of like just sort of giving, like having this like sense of altruism, essentially, not trying to just, I don't know, make what's marketable, right? I think it's a person like, oh shit, what is their name? They make maps. Dyson logos.
Oh, Dyson logos. Yeah.
Dyson logos just makes a like, here, just have my shit. If you pay for it, cool, whatever. But like, just take it, do it. Let's help other people succeed in making their thing. If they can't like draw dungeons or draw landscapes, like don't let that stop you from creating what you're going to do. I'll help you do that. Is that sort of like on the lines of what we're talking about here today?
Yeah, fully. I just think that like, I mean, for me, first and foremost, this is like a hobby space and like a hobby community. This is like something that we do because it's fun and we love it, right? and I think we should try, and I think we should try hard to keep the specter of Mammon from getting its fingers on it as much as we can, in a nutshell.
I love it. I think that's a really great tip, because I think there is this pressure of like, it's like this, all the entrepreneurship, like bro-y stuff that's like, you know, you have to capitalize your dollars for the value of your time, and like you have to wake up at 4:30 every morning so that you can succeed in life.
The fucking rise and grind.
Yeah, the rise and grind, baby. Don't do it. It's bad.
It's gonna poison everything you love.
Yeah, for sure.
I think like it's like find a job that like can support you. That's almost impossible for a lot of people right now, so instead let's try to support each other as best as we can, and let's try to like make art, and like let's not try to connect those two in some like weird unholy union, right? Like we can just all like, I don't know, like it's just like one of those things where like if we pool our resources, we can do a lot more good than if we try to like make it as like individuals. I don't know.
Yeah, I really like the mutual aid thing you mentioned earlier, and that like it'd be so interesting if there was like an industry pool of dollars or something like that.
Yeah, and right? It's like at a large scale that sort of thing falls apart. What you need are like close, tight-knit communities for that to work. But it's like, go find that. Go make that. Go find the people who are interested in doing what you're doing, and, you know, hang out together and make stuff together and support each other. That's my tips and tricks. That's my pro gamer advice.
What's up, gamers? Fartbrain 9000 here. Remember to like and subscribe and hit the notification bell so you can get top tips from Ava every Wednesday at 7 p.m. EST. Did I do it? Is that the YouTube? Am I on YouTube now?
You did it. You nailed it.
It's internalized. I'm poisoned. With that, I think that we are going to come to the top of the show here. Ava, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on again. Would love to have you on a third time and a fourth time. Sorry for everyone who can't hear the first time. There's lots of good juice in there. It just got broken up by the internet. Ava, once again, would you just give a brief outro of who you are, where people can reach you, where they can support you in any manner if they so choose?
For sure. I'm Ava. I make dragon games, and you can find me on Twitter at youngdumbbitch. YUNGDUM bitch. And from there, you can basically find everything else I do. I have a pinned tweet there to pre-order Errant if you want to do that. And also the link to the website where you can basically read almost all the rules for free, because you should be able to do that. And yeah, my blog is permanent cranial damage, permacrandam.blogspot.com. I'm sure that link will be somewhere. And yeah, that's about it. Thanks for listening to me ramble.
Wasn't ramble, was a lecture. Loved it every second. Thank you everyone for hanging out with us today. I hope that you learned a lot, because I certainly did, and we will catch you next time. Say bye to the people, Ava.
Bye, people.
Bye, people. All right, that's a wrap. Thank you for taking the time to sit down and hang out with Ava and I. We really appreciate it. You can find links and resources down below in the show notes, such as getting in touch with Ava or other episodes with similar topics. If you want to be a part of the conversation, please come and join the community Discord server. Also, make sure to subscribe to the Draw Your Dice Patreon, where you can get access to early releases of episodes from as soon as we interview. Thanks again for stopping by, and as always, I will catch you next time.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.